This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings, listeners. It's time for the June episode. I'm editor Ezzy Pearson and I'm joined on the podcast today by staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
Coming up later, we'll be telling you how to observe the partial eclipse that will be visible all across the UK on June the 10th. But for now, we're going to be taking a wider look at the universe. This month marks the 20th anniversary of the launch of the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, better known as WMAP. This was an incredible mission that aimed to map the entire night sky for something called the cosmic microwave background radiation.
Yes, indeed. And I suppose it's worth beginning the podcast by explaining exactly what that is. It's ultimately heat or radiation left over from the Big Bang, really, isn't it? It's sort of the remnants of the beginning of the universe, which is quite exciting to comprehend.
It is. It's the first thing which it is possible to see in the universe. Because what happened originally when the universe first formed, there was the Big Bang, and this made everything in the universe incredibly, incredibly hot. In fact, it was so hot that all of the electrons and protons that normally would have bound together to form a hydrogen atom were so fast flying away from each other that they couldn't connect to each other. They kept flying apart. And this continued for about 370,000 years. And at that point, the universe was constantly expanding after the Big Bang. And 370,000 years after the Big Bang, things had cooled down. It was about 300 degrees Celsius. And it was at that temperature that the atoms could finally bond together again. And what that means is when you have protons and electrons flying around all over the place by themselves, when they're free electrons, they're called, they have a tendency to very, very quickly absorb any photon that hits it. So any particle, any bit of light that hits one of these atoms, it immediately gets absorbed. And that meant that light could only travel, you know, fractions of a nanometer across space. But when those atoms combined, a time that's called recombination, light could suddenly travel distances again. And that's what the CMB is. That's what we're seeing. It's that very, very first wave of light that came out when all of the atoms combined together. However, over time, the universe has been expanding. And whilst that was originally, you know, very hot, visible light, that light's been stretched by something called redshift and eked out and stretched out until it's become very long wavelength type of electromagnetic radiation that we can call microwaves.
Yes, and isn't it the case also that what WMAP's actually measuring is there are essentially these sort of really, really tiny, tiny fluctuations in sort of the in the density and the dimness of this radiation. So, you know, obviously it's incredibly difficult to observe, but it's those tiny, tiny fluctuations that sort of give us a view of what that early universe was like.
So currently the background temperature is about 2.7 Kelvin. So over the last, you know, 13 billion years, things have cooled down a lot. And so now it's only about 2.7 Kelvin. Kelvin being the temperature in degrees Celsius above absolute zero, which is the coldest that anything can be. So 2.7 Kelvin is very, very cold. It's about minus 270 degrees Celsius. And that's what the kind of current temperature of the CMB is. But the fluctuations that scientists with WMAP are looking for are only about 0.003 Kelvin. So that's less than 0.1% changes in fluctuations that WMAP was trying to find.
It's absolutely incredible.
It's astonishing.
It's absolutely incredible, isn't it? I mean, it's ultimately looking at how the universe went from this sort of hot, I mean, I think I've heard a few people describe it as the sort of hot primordial soup, where everything's quite, you know, homogenous and everything's just flying around and like light's being scattered, and to eventually getting to, you know, the seeds of the first stars and galaxies to the universe as we know it today. I think it's interesting, though, going back to the story of how the cosmic microwave background was detected, because, like, you know, some of the greatest scientific discoveries, it was sort of scientists sort of going, oh, that's weird. What's this? it was quite recently, really, wasn't it? Like, it was in the mid-60s, 1964, these two American radio astronomers who just had this strange reading on their... it was like static noise on their equipment, and they initially thought it might have been like pigeon droppings on their antenna.
Yes, there was a couple of pigeons that were living inside the antenna, and even once they had removed the pigeons, shall we say politely, and cleaned everything out, they were still getting this kind of like weird background hiss, and they were wondering what on earth it could be. And it turned out that actually there was quite a lot of people who'd done sort of theoretical work, sort of saying like, oh, there might be this kind of background radiation to the universe left over from the Big Bang. That sort of idea had been around since the 1950s. It just turned out that the two astronomers, so it was Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, who actually, you know, observed the CMB, the guys with the pigeons, they hadn't read these papers. They didn't know. They just published this sort of thing saying, like, we've got this weird background hiss. Does anybody know what it is? And then all of the kind of like theoretical astronomers just went, well, there goes my Nobel Prize. It had been discovered by these people who weren't even looking.
Because they reached out to astrophysicists at Princeton University, which is, I think, was quite close to where they were operating. I really love that, you know, because they were radio astronomers, you know, they had these like hisses in their antenna, you know, they could have called all manner of people, but it's like, no, let's call the astrophysicists at Princeton and see what they think. I wonder what those astronomers at Princeton, like, did they immediately sort of think, oh, these guys could be onto something here, or do we know whether or not the astronomers at Princeton were initially sort of like, well, it could be anything, like, why are you asking us, kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, as I said, there were some people who had kind of who had sort of theorized that this is what this might be. And pretty quickly after to looking at the data and sort of looking at the information that they had, it was quite like they soon realized that this is what it is.
Wilson and Penzias then subsequently in 1978 won the Nobel Prize for Physics for the discovery, mm-hmm. which is quite cool, isn't it?
Yeah. So it tends to be that when it comes to Nobel Prizes, is especially on something like this, when it was predicted by somebody else, but it was first observed by these people, the Nobel Prize tends to go to the people who actually like made the observations and could like prove it.
Yeah.
Which I believe causes some consternation sometimes, but in this case.
Yeah. I mean, not to sort of drag up like a different story, but that's what it makes you think of Jocelyn Burnell, you know, discovering the first pulsar, but she was the one who observed it, but she didn't get the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Back to WMAP. I mean, it wasn't the first mission to study the cosmic microwave background, was it? Because as far as I know, the first sort of mission to study it was COBE, the Cosmic Background Explorer, which operated between 1989 and 1993. And it produced the first full sky map of the CMB and revealed these sort of fluctuations in temperature, that, as we said, that revealed the structure of the universe 380,000 years after the Big Bang. But then sort of, I suppose what WMAP was doing was refining what COBE had sort of discovered before it.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Listen closely. As a master painter carefully brushes Benjamin Moore Regal Select down the seam of the wall. It's like poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
Want to be more active this summer? Sierra helps you save on everything from swimsuits to stand-up paddle boards, tennis rackets to fishing tackle. And if that doesn't float your boat, we also have pool floats. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when it comes to the cosmic microwave background, you really want to have like the global image. You want to have the full picture of what it's like in every single direction. And that's very hard to do from the ground because your telescope can look up. It can cover, like if it can move around, it might be able to cover quite a large area of sky, but it can't cover the whole sky. Like no telescope can because Earth gets in the way. So that was why both COBE and WMAP were space-based. So these were the first full sky maps. And that gives you kind of like the entire view of what these fluctuations, they're called anisotropies, hence the anisotropies in the name of WMAP. And these are the kind of tiny fluctuations in the background that are basically the artifacts, the remnants of fluctuations in where matter was and the quantum state of the universe right the way back at the beginning when that universe cooled down and light could emit. So it basically gives us our view of what the universe looked like when it was only 370,000 years old. And knowing that, cosmologists and people who are trying to work out how the universe grew to the way it is today can really get to grips and understand how we've come on that journey.
Do those fluctuations in any way relate to the observable matter in the universe as we see it today? Like, did those dense fluctuations relate to, like, were they the seeds of what then became galaxies? Is it a pattern that fits the universe as it currently exists?
Well, it's quite a complicated relationship of how the universe in that current state, how it then transferred to being galaxies and the structure that we see today. But it does carry a lot of information. So the people who work out how the the cosmologists who work out how the universe grows, they know from various mathematical models and formulas that they've worked out, they know how they think, given a certain start, what the universe would grow into today. And that's exactly what they did with WMAP. They had basically the list of ingredients. Like, so you're trying to cook a universe. They had the list of ingredients for the recipe. They had the steps that they needed to take to bake a universe. But what they didn't have was how much there was of each of those various ingredients or how long they needed to bake. And so that was kind of what they were trying to work out. But now that they had this picture of what the universe looked like back right at the beginning, they could kind of run that situation through their plan of how they think that you make a universe, and just keep trying it over again with changing, you know, like how old the universe is, what it's made up of, and keep tweaking those numbers until they found something that looked like today's universe. So going from one to the other is a fairly complicated procedure, but by doing that in a computer, that was how they managed to work out kind of some of the factors of our universe.
So initially they were essentially like they were doing the technical challenge on the Great British Bake Off. You got the ingredients, yeah, and really vague instructions. Good luck.
Yeah, sort of. And some of them ended up, like, they got it right and it looked like a beautiful flan. And on others, it was a great big mess. So, yeah.
Just like
the Great British Bake Off. However, they ran, you know, did thousands and thousands of different simulations until they, like, precisely pinpointed exactly, like, all of these various different numbers.
Amazing.
The set of numbers is something called the cosmological parameters. And this is kind of like our description of what kind of universe we live in. And in order to kind of get their simulated universe to look like actual universe, you needed to have these like really, really precisely spot on. It's actually like surprising how spot on you needed to be, which is why these values are now believed to be so accurate.
Incredible. You had sort of touched on the orbit of WMAP, so I thought it was maybe worth actually going through the sort of technical aspects of the actual spacecraft, mm-hmm, and the space telescope and what it actually did. So it launched on the 30th of June 2001, as we said, and over nine years it orbited in the Lagrangian point, L2. Around the sun, so and every 6 months it would do an orbit and it would make a new map of the entire sky, allowing the astronomers back on Earth to refine their map of the sky and their data. I always think those Lagrangian points sort of need explaining. So Lagrange point, the Lagrange points are these positions in space within the Earth-Sun system, and L2 is a position where there's a stable orbit. So if you wanted to put a space telescope in L2, the gravitational pull between both the sun and Earth is such that it can remain pretty much, the spacecraft in that orbital point can remain pretty much unperturbed because it's a nice sort of balance. Point of interest, that's where JWST is going to be, the James Webb Space Telescope. So it's the same sort of orbital path or point. Another really interesting aspect of all these sort of space telescope missions, like the Planck and things like that, WMAP, is that when you get down to it, they are ultimately really, really cool telescopes. WMAP was effectively two back-to-back reflecting telescopes. They had 1.4 by 1.6 meter primary reflectors and 0.9 by 1 meter secondary reflectors. So they really just like sort of like reflecting telescopes that would observe radiation. And they had radiometers to amplify and convert the signals that it detected into this sort of like quantifiable data that could then be sent back to scientists on Earth, which was another advantage of the L2 point. Because there are a few reasons that you put it there. One was, to be able to send the data back to Earth. But the other one is so that basically the Sun and Earth can be behind the spacecraft. So sort of the sort of microwave emissions of Earth and the Sun aren't, getting in the way of its data. So you can get nice clean data. But also at the same time, you're sort of relatively close enough to the Sun that your solar panels can get power. So WMAP had solar panels and also had a nice solar shield to keep the satellite operating, at a sort of nice thermal equilibrium.
So one of the cool things about the L2 point is that it's kind of Earth pulls you along a bit whilst you're in that orbit, so your spacecraft keeps pace with the Earth. So as you're going around the Sun, even though you're much further out, I think it's, 1.5 million kilometers from Earth? I think L2 is.
It is, yeah.
You're always in the same part of the orbit as it. You're not like lagging behind or getting ahead, which makes it a lot easier if you're trying to communicate with the spacecraft and it hasn't fallen behind you and is, half a million miles on the other side of the solar system.
It was a really cool mission, WMAP, when you think about it. I mean, loads of the facts that we now know about the observable universe, the age of the universe being 13.8 billion years, and this notion of observable matter only makes up about 5% of the universe, the rest is being dark matter and dark energy. Energy causing the acceleration of the expansion of the universe, dark matter being this invisible, undetectable, unobservable force matter that has gravitational pull. I mean, that's already sort of come about as a result of the WMAP mission, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So earlier I mentioned something called the cosmological parameters, and that's what those numbers mean in ways that, us normal people who don't speak, 15 pages of calculations, That's what these numbers mean. So yes, it found out that they knew previously that the universe was made up of something called baryonic matter, which is basically like normal matter, like it's you, me, the planet, the sofa I'm currently sitting on. That's all made of baryonic matter. That makes up about 5% of the universe. 25% was dark matter, which is the stuff that keeps galaxies together and stops them flying apart. And then 70% was this mysterious dark energy, which is something that appears to be driving the universe apart. And that was another thing that WMAP kind of pinned down, is the fact that the universe is expanding, but not just expanding, it's accelerating. Prior to WMAP, that was something that a lot of people suspected, but nobody knew for sure. Like, there was a lot of conflict about the fact that the universe was accelerating its expansion. Because, I mean, think about it. It's like the further apart something gets, like, you think over time it would eventually start slowing down as it kind of runs out of energy. But that didn't happen. Instead, it seems to all be shooting apart from each other suddenly. So people came up with this idea of dark energy to explain that. And it seems to make up about 70% of the universe. I always find that a little bit distressing when you realize that 95% of the universe is made up of stuff. It's like, we don't really know what it is. It's just there.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible when you think that, like the last podcast we did, we were talking about the Great Debate of 1920, where two astronomers, Shapley and Curtis, were discussing whether or not, like the Milky Way is the universe, or whether other galaxies exist, the scale of the universe. And then what is it like 70 years later? We're sending a space telescope to measure the you know, measure the background radiation left from the Big Bang and discovering, you know, what the early universe was like in its infancy. And within this matter of like 70 years, it's absolutely incredible, yeah, isn't it?
It is.
Do you think that a mission like WMAP was sort of the point at which cosmology ceased to be largely theoretical and became more of a sort of deducible science that you could prove with data and facts and mathematics?
Oh, absolutely. You know, before then, they had the COBE probe, which managed to kind of measure a couple of these numbers. But for a lot of these kind of parameters and the various like aspects of our universe that cosmologists wanted, they didn't really have a proper way of measuring half of them. And the ones that they did, they could only sort of vaguely guess at. Whereas when WMAP came along, they could suddenly like get really, really precise measurements about what they think these numbers are. It's estimated that it was about a 70,000 times improvement on these measurements. Given that, you know, some of them they couldn't even measure beforehand, it's like it was a jump forward. I remember I was talking to the PI of WMAP, the primary investigator of WMAP, and he was saying the first time that he showed a cosmologist kind of like the list of numbers that they'd come up with and like the precision that they had these list of numbers, it was just like their jaws dropped because they couldn't, even though they knew that it was going to be really good, it was sort of like suddenly after all of these years with very little data having these precise measurements, it was just an absolute game changer for them. It transferred, you know, something that was kind of like a wishy-washy area of science into like a hardcore precision field.
So cool. And it sort of, you know, all started with, you know, two radio astronomers in the 1960s going, what is that hissing? It's really annoying. What is it? It makes you wonder, you know, what might eventually enable someone to actually discover what dark matter is or what dark energy is. Maybe it'd be something like that. And then, you know, within our lifetime, there'll be space telescopes designed to actually observe dark matter being launched and actually observing it.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those reasons why it's so important to do like different areas of science and look at different things, because you never know where the next breakthrough is going to come from. It's like it could come from somebody going, I wonder what that is.
Yeah, indeed. I found a really nice quote by Adam Riess, the astrophysicist who in 2011 was the winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics for his work showing that the universe's expansion is accelerating. And he was talking about the WMAP mission, and he said, the last word from WMAP marks the end of the beginning in our quest to understand the universe. WMAP has brought precision to cosmology, and the universe will never be the same. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
It breaks my mind a bit.
I know.
But there is just something very gratifying about being able to kind of work out where we are in the world. And that's one of the reasons why people do astronomy and cosmology and all of these sciences, is that kind of need to know where we came from. In this case, in a much larger sense than
indeed
a lot of other sciences. It's like, where did everything come from?
Yeah. Not, you know, oh yeah, how did humans evolve? How was the Earth formed? Just how did everything come into existence? And perhaps ultimately, how will everything end, you know?
Oh, how things are going to end, there's a completely different issue. But if our listeners do want to find out more about the work that WMAP did and what it showed us about our universe, then they can pick up the June issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we have a feature telling you all about it.
And now it's time for this month's Stargazing Tip. Thursday the 10th of June, we'll see the occurrence of an annular solar eclipse, where the moon will pass in front of the sun but won't block it completely, leaving a so-called ring of fire visible to those in the far northern hemisphere, in territories like Canada, Greenland, and Siberia. Those of us viewing in the UK, Northern Europe, the United States and other regions, however, will be treated instead to a partial solar eclipse, where the moon only covers part of the sun. This month, it will be worth your while catching a glimpse of the event if you can. From the UK, the eclipse occurs late morning and favours those living in the northwest of the country, with viewers in the Shetland Islands getting to see more of the sun's diameter obscured by the moon than in other UK regions, as much as 39%. Viewers in London will see an obscuration of 20%, in Cardiff 22%, in Belfast 30%, and in Edinburgh 31%. From the UK, the eclipse will begin shortly after 10 a.m. BST, and provided the skies are clear, should produce a spectacular display. However, because the sun won't be completely blocked out by the moon, caution is required when viewing a partial solar eclipse, as looking directly at the sun with the naked eye can seriously damage your eyesight. If you do want to view the partial eclipse, there are numerous ways you can do so safely, including wearing a pair of certified eclipse glasses, by projecting an image of the sun onto a piece of white card, or by using specially designed solar telescopes and solar binoculars. For more information on the eclipse and how to view it safely, visit www.skyatnightmagazine.com or pick up or download the June 2021 issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine.
So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about WMAP in the June issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also take a look at what the UK Parliament is doing to tackle light pollution, learn how to image the planets of the solar system, and find out how you can re-edit images taken by professional telescopes from the comfort of your own home. And that's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Brittany Colley. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to Acast, iTunes, or Spotify.